Dear ChatGPT, I am still struggling to film this YouTube video to open up my new season of my podcast. I am feeling so anxious about what to say after everything I've been through this year. What do you think I, Kara Burrell, need to hear? Enter. Kara, take a deep breath and remind yourself of this. You've already done the hardest part, surviving. Everything you've been through this year, divorce, rediscovering yourself, reimagining your life, is proof that you're stronger and more capable than you often give yourself credit for. You've already faced the storms, and here you are, standing, creating, and ready to share your voice again. That's huge. Here's what you need to hear. One, your story has power, even if it's messy. Two, you don't have to carry the weight of everyone's expectations. Three, your authenticity is your superpower. Dear ChatGPT, are you single? What you could say to open the video, start with something simple and honest. Hey friends, it's Kara Burrell. Starting this season feels heavy and exciting all at once. This year has been a wild ride, kissing strangers at, skip that part, and figuring out who I really am after leaving Mormonism. I've learned a lot, laughed a lot, cried a lot, and I don't like the writing on that. It's not good. And today, I'm here to share some of it with you. Let's get into it. From there, just let it flow. Remember, the courage to press record is the same courage that will carry you through the rest of the video. Okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the start of this brand new season of this podcast that I call the Mormon History Hoedown. My name is Kara Burrell. Sometimes I go by Nuance Ho. Sometimes I need to take long breaks from what I would call this ex-Mormon space. I created about 50 episodes of this podcast that I'm really proud of. Needed to take some time to do some things in my personal life and decide exactly how I want to interact with the space. So I deleted a lot of stuff. Like my Instagram is like 90% gone, and just be a lot more choosy about the spaces in which I go into this place that I've been in for so long. And just the pendulum swings wide. And then it's like, when it comes back, it's like a claw machine, just like kind of only taking its favorite things out of it. So that makes any sense. I do my Tim Ballard stuff on the side, and it's kind of a very dark space. Today, I wanted to do a Q&A, and if you're new here, I'm going to start with the first question of what made me leave the church, since that's what people always want to know anyway. But all these questions I've collected are something that really just like run the gamut. And if your question's not here, you can leave it in the comments. So the first question, the biggest one, is what made you leave the church? And the answer is basically July 12th, 2019. I realized it was not a true thing. I had a husband who was already kind of on a path to leave or LGBTQ issues, and I was trying to decide, how am I going to interact with this church now that I have to take my kids by myself? And I went on the internet one day and I typed in basically to YouTube, like, what are ex-Mormons problems? And I found out that they had some good points, and it was, you can choose, you know, orthodoxy and going with what feels like safe and prescribed for you. And then you can go for like empathy. And my way of deconstructing is like, if you keep hitting that empathy button, you and the church are just going to diverge. And so it was a lot of my empathy that I had for the struggles of LGBTQ people and my husband loving him and knowing that that was true, that was right, but I was still trying to snuff that down. But I'm like, okay, but do they have other problems? And I first watched a video about the Book of Abraham, and once you realize that something like that is makes your church just indistinguishable from a fraud, where Joseph Smith is like, these are the characters that I think this Egyptian says from God, and other people are like, well, we're Egyptologists, and we say absolutely not, you've got that wrong. And I did some apologetics and stuff that same night when I was discovering all these things. And what really cracked my shelf, what really brought it all down, was the apologetics on Mormonism. I was like, surely somebody smarter and wiser has thought of these things. Surely if I go looking, I can find the answers to why this is actually okay. And the Fair Mormon website, it would have been better if they just said nothing. I was like, that's the best you can do? Because all they can come back with is like, well, Joseph, he had to have the Egyptian papyri. He didn't need it because he's so awesome. He just needed it to not, it didn't even matter if it was translating it and it matched up. That's, Your worldly eyes are deceiving you. He actually just needed it as like a catalyst. It's like sometimes he translates things with a rock and a hat, or sometimes he knows what God wants him to say with like absolutely nothing in front of him. And then sometimes he needs ancient funerary texts that he doesn't know he's going to be fact checked on. And I thought that was dumb. I thought that I wasn't going to be able to be on board with that. And then it just got worse from there, learning about polygamy and all kinds of things that had been hidden from me in the church. And I'm like, I would not have made the same choices if I had known this information. And closed my computer at like 3 o'clock in the morning and thought, oh my gosh, wow, it's a not true thing. I'm never walking into a church building ever again. And then a little bit after that, I deconstructed some other things, which we can get into. Is Mormonism a cult? A lot has been said on this. This is my take. So there's a lot of ways to define like the harm continuum. I've had Stephen Hassan on my podcast before with like the bite model. And all we need to focus on is like the harm continuum. What I like to do is think about how the church treats ex-members, how they talk about them to believing members, and then what you're told if you left, like all of those things. So like the role of Satan is implemented a lot in the minds of Mormons, that when you've left, you've done so because of the enticings of Satan. So are members actually given a pathway to leave with their dignity? That dogmatic nature also lends itself to these thought-stopping cliches to keep people in line. And I think that one of the indicators that reveal if an organization like Mormonism is a cult, there's this saying that podcaster Jonathan Streeter has coined called wood tools versus steel tools. And it's about utilizing these different thought-stopping cliches to help a person maintain a belief. And if you do like this outsider's test for faith, and if you knew that a loved one was in a false religion, and they were saying the same things that your false religion basically gives you, how would you help them get out if you utilize those same phrases as well? So like common ones would be, it's not important to your salvation, you can stop thinking about it, or that's a mystery of God to test your faith. And if God commands it, then it's inherently right. And don't worry about this right now, we'll figure it out in the afterlife. And then you contrast that with what you would hope would be things like scientific method and like actual genuine inquiry that doesn't have such dogmatic results if you keep questioning. So the opposite of that, of wood tools, is open inquiry. It is steel tools. Ask any question to, you know, current or former members. There's no limits on the questions that you're allowed to ask. So the answer and the question to me is like, Mormonism a cult? The best thing you're going to get from me is saying like, yeah, did I feel like I was in a cult? Yes. Did I feel like it was a name brand cult? Of all the cults I could have chosen, yeah, I'm glad I got the Mormon one. But when it comes to, is it true? That's a different question. Is it useful? That's a different question. Is it a cult? Are we saying that because we're trying to be shocking or offensive, or are we trying to look at like this harm continuum of like, what does it say about a church and a people and a culture whose God that they worship is so much like a cult? What does that say about the nature of God and what he thinks is the best epistemology to learn about him, to worship him, when it is so similar to other cults? That's what I would say on that. With that being said, next question is, what does Mormonism get right? So we're going to get into a whole gamut of other things. We're on intense Mormon talk right now. What does Mormonism get right? Could say a lot on this. The nuanceo could rant endlessly. I had a good time in the church. I didn't leave because I had a bad time. I left because it's a not true thing. So despite its flaws, what does Mormonism get right? I think that it just makes sense for a lot of people because it makes a good deal. And it's the kind of deal that humans have historically always liked making, because religion does some very heavy lifting and that cannot be denied. And it gives a person identity and community. And I think the type of purpose and morality that benefits them and their tribe. And I left because I realized it was not a true thing. And then my husband Aaron left, like I mentioned, because of his beliefs about the inherent worth of people in the LGBTQ plus community. And I had spent about 7 years as an evangelical kind of Jesus freak inside the church. And then it was on Easter Sunday in 2019 that he told me that would be the last time he'd ever go to church again. And I had a lot of thinking about what I wanted to do. And that's when I did this search and I figured out the things that I did that made it a not true thing. But because I had like this kind of very evangelical Christian heart inside of me, I was like, okay, so that's not a true thing. Then we can investigate these other things. So I was in shock for a few days about that. But then I still had my beliefs in the Bible and Jesus Christ. And then once I deconstructed that those were also not true things, that's when a lot more of like this void and this dark night of the soul kind of stuff comes in. It was like the next morning and my mom called me and told me that my dad was going in for like emergency open heart surgery and then he might die. So a lot of that was happening all at the same time, all for me to be like, okay, damn, what do I actually think about families and the afterlife? And will I ever get to see my dad again? Is it even moral to see my dad again? He wears a yarmulke underneath his Trump hat. It's a thing. We tried to tell him to take it off. We're like, do I really need to interact with this person? Yes, I do. I love him. All of those very complicated feelings all came on at that time. And that's why I say that, like, what Mormonism gets right is it makes a deal with humanity, with our psyches that historically has been very popular to be like, oh no, this is extreme existential pain. What are some myths and what are some rituals that I can do that will make me feel all better and connect me with my family and my tribe? So that being said, there are a lot of things within Mormonism that feel very right and very true, like the structure and the certainty and the exclusivity that comes with it. But those are also obviously its greatest limitations. I like to compare it to like a Snuggie, where like nobody asks for a Snuggie. Like you don't buy a Snuggie. No one asks for a Snuggie, but like you just end up getting a Snuggie. That's like religion. Like it's like given to you. And yes, it's like, yeah, I need something because I'm cold to wear. And by cold, I mean like existential dread. And by wear, I mean like a mask that makes me show up and be liked by my community and my parents. But with a Snuggie, you can't be asking a lot of questions like, this is okay that I wear it to Walmart, right? Like it's not, just don't ask questions about it. So when you start asking questions about the nature of your Snuggie and who's allowed in it, but the Snuggie does not like you asking questions. And a Snuggie by another name is actually just a straitjacket. And that's what religion can turn into. So that's kind of where the unraveling begins. Pulled that all together. Thank you so much. So with what Mormonism does right, so for me personally, it removed a lot of anxieties. I know you think I'm going to be crazy for saying this, but when you have this very clear avenue to when you're feeling anxious and you can say a prayer and like your Savior and Redeemer gives you warm fuzzies inside that tell you that everything's actually going to be okay and you're like a perfect daughter of God and everything's just how it's supposed to be, I have gotten to that same place with true things, but that took a long time to understand how to build those things. And that's kind of already built into how I had my religious experience, had a good method for relieving a lot of anxiety. And I know you're thinking like, what about all the unnecessary anxiety and OCD that it already puts on your head? Me and God were cool. I have a one in a million cool time in Mormonism because I had some childhood trauma we won't talk about right now. But that kind of made me feel like if I wanted to masturbate or something, God was cool with it. He's like, I know I shouldn't have put you through that and it's fine. And you're one of my strongest soldiers. And because of that, you're allowed to name the showerhead anything you want to. So obviously Mormonism didn't do that because it didn't do that for anyone else. But something within my understanding in how I was raised and my brain, my genetics, however the fuck I showed up, that was my experience with the Mormon God. It gave me something to aim for, something, again, that taught me to be disciplined, where I could have made a lot of choices in my life. And getting married to like a really nice guy and spending 16 wonderful years with him while being Mormon for 10 of them wasn't the worst thing in the world, but also has, you know, a lot of unmet personal needs and other unmet personal milestones and personal development and things like that. But that's, yes, why religion wants people to get married young. It benefits what they're trying to do. And for better or for worse, like that is exactly how my life played out. I aimed for something. And as soon as I was available to get married, married my first boyfriend when I was 19. And that kind of structure with all of its flaws, I still think was probably the best thing that could have happened for me, given the kind of childhood that I had and the way that the church was able to be this structured place for me, yes, given all of its flaws. And yes, there's a million different bad experiences that people have, which makes perfect sense within a very systemically corrupt and false system. But in speaking about what Mormonism does right for me at this point in my life right now, my mom is being really nice. I don't, can't tell the whole story, but mom, if you're watching this, I love you. My mom's helping me out a lot. My mom, she is a Christian saint and we love her. And I think it makes people very service oriented, and I have been the beneficiary of that. Okay. And then this question goes along with that as well. It says, what do you miss about Mormonism? So going along that same train of thought, because saying like just community, I think is overplayed, but when I was working at this summer camp, it really hit home how everybody is raised within some kind of community. So I had extremely quality leaders, like feminist leaders in Provo, Utah, and mentors that I think modeled me more than anything. Like, that was my community. And if you have to be plopped down anywhere in the world, I think my lucky stars that that was my plopping. So it's like, I looked at my kids in this environment at camp, and I was an administrator, and there's so many battles that I had to choose of which ones to actually work on and fight and improve, pick my battles of what things I was going to care about. And it was 1,000 times more stressful than I can ever even put words to. So every few days at camp, they'll do like these big campfires. And again, this is like very wealthy camp that's neither here nor there in Western Massachusetts, made up of like very rich Jewish children, basically from like New York and the surrounding tri-state area. And I've worked at a camp like this before. I knew what I was getting myself in for, but there's just certain moments where you're like, if I continue to work here, if I continue to bring my kids back here, and then this is what the camp produces when like they turn 15, 16 and they leave camp, would I be proud if my daughter was friends with these people, if they acted like this? I know teenagers will be teenagers. And so I don't put too much, like, I'm not trying to come down too hard on the camp or anything, but this just was one of these moments where I had a difference between a place where you're going to have a childhood environment, like say a summer camp, and camp culture is very intense. So like they live in a different planet in terms of a lot of the things that I value and I would actually want my kids to embody in the future. So this is a long rambling answer, but they have these campfires every few days. And at one of them, all of the oldest kids were all standing in the front while the rest of the camp is like facing them. And my 8-year-old daughter, who was on the spectrum, and she was doing so great at camp for the first like 3 weeks. And I think I have a question about why we left, and it has to do with her, I think, basically like masking for the first couple of days. But she's a silly girl. Man, she is funny. So at this one of these campfires, I'm not sitting with her because I'm trying to like not be a mom and like keep my distance, you know. But if I was sitting next to her, I would have probably had her not raise her hand and ask this question to the owner of the camp and be like, ask me first so you don't embarrass yourself. But you got to let your kids embarrass themselves, I guess. So that's just what happened. And she's sitting front row center, and he asks if there's any questions. And my daughter raises her hand, and she says a joke that we were joking about at the last campfire, where she says, for like my special activity, can I dig holes and look for the buried treasure that he was talking about in the speech, that there's like this buried treasure at camp. And she's like, for my special activity, can I dig holes and look for buried treasure? So that was her question. So I know that she probably is going to say that. She's got that locked and loaded. And he's going person to person of different kids raising their hand in the crowd. And my daughter is raising her hand, like, and then all of the teenage girls who are standing in front, I see them and they're like, Gwen, Gwen, pick Gwen. And they're screaming to pick Gwen. And I'm like playing mama bear for a second. And I'm like, are they doing that because they know she's going to say something kind of stupid that's going to like ostracize her from her friends? Like, are they using her at their expense to like laugh at her? Or do they genuinely like think she's a cool kid and want her to voice her question to the camp? It was the former. So she asks her question, and then the owner of the camp just goes like, he doesn't understand what the heck she's talking about. And he just goes like, no, just keep the questions related to what we're talking about right now. And he moves on. He's like totally confused. And I just look it over at the, like, the oldest group of girls, and they just are busting up, like falling over themselves laughing. And my mama bear goes like, they're laughing at the expense of my like spectrum daughter. I don't like the way that feels. I don't like it at all. And should they have like done better. They're 15-year-old girls. Like, I don't know. Like, I totally get it. But at the same time, I'm like, fuck you guys. No, this is where my mama bear comes in. I'm like, I don't want anything to do with people who act like this. And there's a lot of girls with like eating disorders and a lot of talk about sex at too young of an age and just a lot of things that like any culture that you're going to go in is going to have the kids around it that kind of raise it. And the Mormon kids that I was raised around, I'm like, they would have never acted like this. And I'm not trying to come down on this camp specifically because I can say 1,000 really good things about the kids at camp too, but it just, that kind of thing really irked me. And so I thought to myself how much I looked up to like the Laurels in my state growing up and the girls' camps that we had. And I know I'll get pushback on saying this, but like to me, I have the happiest memories at girls camp and how supportive and loving the Laurels were. Yes, because they're like raised to be trad wives and they love kids like an extraordinary amount. Whatever the reasoning is, I just like a group of Mormon 6-year girls in my experience just would never in so many different arenas. And I just, so for me, the nuance has to say like a lot of aspects that I loved about being Mormon were like genuine sweet people who looked out for each other. And then I'll lead into the next question about why I left camp early. So basically my 8-year-old, she was having just too many meltdowns. I wanted to be able to serve my counselors and do what they needed and what the kids needed. And she just pulled a lot of attention away from that. So I couldn't just send her home. So we all left me, my 10-year-old daughter. And it's a decision that I agreed with totally, but I wish we had like more time and flexibility to try something else and make it work because she loved camp life so much. And so that was painful on the last day to not be able to have that kind of flexibility. Because it was a little bit sudden, but it worked out. I was really glad that I went home. So happy that I went home early. Honestly, I have stories from my counselors that I managed who just it kept getting worse and worse. Just a lot of things about the camp didn't get better as with time went on. So I was happy that I was able to have some really fun experiences, make good memories. My kids had a blast and then peace out. So that's why we came home early. Next question. Do you regret staying in the church as long as you did? Nope. I mean, if you can't tell, I'm pretty like chill with how life just happens, you know? So no regrets, no regrets. I think life is a journey and I'm just grateful for everything that I've been through and things happen. Next, what is your favorite memory from childhood? My favorite overall memory, but my childhood, let me just spell this out for you. Provo, North Provo neighborhood. And there's a White Chapel on Canyon Road. That's like the neighborhood. There's a big field there. So down from that field is this big hill. There's a charter school there now. But before that charter school was there, there was this abandoned summer camp down that hill called Camp Mariotti. Had all my first kisses with boys there. And in the winter, we could like sled and make jumps for our snowboards and stuff. And then me and my friends, we had like, we named one of the sledding trails like the Butt Jingler and we just laughed our heads off. And then in the summertime, it had a river that went through it. And I wrote a paper in high school about my favorite day of my life. And reason I'm bringing this up because it still is just like, ah. And me and my little guy friends, we made little boats and we called them our boaties. And we threw them down the river and watched them go by and just... And then by around the time that we got in 9th grade, one of the boys realized that he was hot stuff and then got a girlfriend and ditched me. And then I became friends with girls. Next, what is the hardest part about leaving the church? The divorce. Next is, what have you learned through all this? Thank you for asking that question. How I view things. You're on your own, kid. You always have been. I have learned that Taylor Swift, she's not just a billionaire money-making hit machine. She also speaks poetry into my life. I've learned that I can appreciate Taylor Swift more than I even realized I could before. Truly. So besides the fact that I learned that you're on your own, kid, you always have been, and that I am the anti-hero and I should not be left to my own devices. They come with vices. I end up in crisis, tale as old as time. A lot of Taylor Swift lyrics that I have learned are personally true for me. But life is chaos, is what I've learned. In and out of the church, things are going to come out. And now that I have deconstructed, I have teared down something. And how do I move through the world? How do I show up? What is my view on things? I could go on this endless tangent. what I have learned through all this is that, for instance, perceptions are really, really important. And I like to, I have a lot of different things and modalities that run through my head on a daily basis. One of the biggest ones is this saying that I'm not going to get right, but it's basically like, you can win 1,000 battles, but if you don't win the one that's within your own head, then you've lost all of them. Something about how you, there's different iterations, like you can conquer a whole city, but if you don't conquer yourself, what was it all for? That kind of idea. So you take down one thing, but you have to still find what else is built within you and then what else you want to build. And so the perceptions come in that are really important to know that you are the thinker of these thoughts and to not get so intertwined in narratives that really prohibit you from moving forward in different kind of victim complexes, where you could say to yourself, okay, given that I was raised within like the confines of a cult or X, Y, and Z, whatever, given that, now how am I going to show up and what am I going to do? So I've really learned how to operate every single day moving forward with, given what my circumstances are now, with what is available to me, what am I in control of and what do I actually want to do? And so when you have deconstructed one thing, whether it's your faith or your marriage, and by marriage, I mean like who you are. What I mean is like who the freak you are. And when you deconstructed one idea about who you are and you're rebuilding who you are and what kind of modus operandi you show up in the world, it's very difficult to find, you know, your identity from one that was just so easily prescribed for you. So perception comes in a lot. And if you follow me, this is going to get hopefully not very confusing. So if you like have a perception of X, like X is wrong or X is good or whatever you have an idea about something, to know that that is still just trusting your view of a perception, and a lot of stuff you can really let go, because I'm not trying to sound like I'm saying what I'm about to say is too literal, but if you want to look at the world in like an entire hologram, I can only see one side of this hologram. You're seeing the other side of it. I'm not seeing your side. You're not seeing mine. Kara, don't you just mean like walk a mile in somebody else's shoes? Yes, but I want to talk about holograms. No. So not that I literally think anything like too hippy dippy or spiritual or metaphysical about like the nature of our reality necessarily, but these are useful tools. So knowing that I am just the perceiver of this reality, somebody else is seeing a perception on the other side, and what's within my control is recognizing that I am the perceiver of these things. And so the normal path that like you would go down would be like doing what's prescribed by your religion or your culture or your family or, you know, the patterns that you've done before. And when you're doing something that is not within that prescribed path and your heart and your mind and everything is like shouting at you that like, this is not normal, this is not convenient, like this is too out of my norm, to know that at the end of the day, that you are just the perceiver of that, that you are still just trusting the perception that you have about this thing is correct. What I'm trying to say is real hands-off approach, real hands-off is a big thing that I've learned. Trusting that I have the correct perception on a lot of things all the time can just lead to a spiral all the time. This is me being the most nuanced person alive, I hope, but it's really aided my life well. So anyway, if you can just be very hands-off in your perceptions and recognize that you can question narratives and don't need to get so tied down to your perception or somebody else's perception and just kind of let things go, that is what really feels the best, because I know that I am infinitely loved and supported however things go. So it leads me into this thought. So for example, Mormonism, false. Once I left Mormonism, I just kept asking questions, and I recommend just never stop asking questions about everything basically. So that if you can commit to having radical honesty, like radical curiosity about the world and about yourself without holding onto things too tightly, and radical honesty again with knowing that you are rooted in something that you truly value that will carry you through all of the turbulence. So I'm rooted in being radically honest with myself first and foremost, and then not really giving a big fuck about what other people do. Because I have to live with myself. I have to like lay my head down on my pillow at night and know that I showed up the best that I could. And a lot of other things are out of my control. So a radical honesty, and then feeling safe though, that there's no judgment, and that the clouds of thought, you can say, that come into your mind, you can spend a lot of time being the noticer of those thoughts and noticing what you feel, but then resting in a commitment to it all just being really morally neutral, because you can't control your thoughts. And a lot more things, the big secret of life to me is a lot more things are morally neutral than your anxieties want to tell you that they are, coming at least from where I came from. So holistically speaking, to carve out that safety within yourself, that there's no wrong answers, and that there's just answers and actions that aren't in alignment with your well-being, and you'll find that out, and you can trust yourself, and you'll be fine. And that whatever destination that you get to might not be what you planned. I sound like I'm repositioning your pigeon pose in yoga right now. I'm sorry. But whatever destination that you get to might not be what you had in mind. But if you stay in alignment with your values and you can hold space for all of these different perspectives and these different things, you'll be in a place that you're proud to be in at the end. Makes sense. I didn't mean to line up these questions in order where they all kind of effortlessly flow into the next. The next question is, how do you stay grounded when it feels like everything's falling apart? I have had days where I have been like, it's going to be a 48 hours in bed kind of weekend. And I have the saying that I wrote this: to every season, turn, turn, turn. There is a reason, turn, turn, turn. I think I created that and not God or the Beatles. Pretty sure that was an original Kara idea. If it's not, it's still true. And, you know, it's fine to live life in seasons of grief, and you don't have to have everything be put together. That's why I've taken a lot of time off to be like, there's not a chance in hell I'm turning on a camera and acting like I know jack shit right now, because my brain is very overwhelmed. So I know when I'm operating from a place of overwhelm when I journal. Big journaler, online journal, changed my life. You can paste your journals into ChatGPT and it'll tell you what the fuck your problem is. Highly recommend. Ask it to look for blind spots, victim complexes, and also ask it to roast you. So to the question of staying grounded when everything feels like it's falling apart, when I went to camp, I re-listened to this episode about grounding that Margie Dillon did, and I texted her bawling. I was like, this is so good. And one of just the normal exercises that I've taken with me is like, I feel my feet on the ground. There's these Buddhist cones that I've been using too over the last few months. One is like, what is this moment lacking? And who is the thinker of these thoughts, basically? And I really like the, what is this moment lacking? Especially when my clothes are off. Hey, I'm talking about when I was in the shower, I needed a loofah. So asking, what is this moment lacking, is such a good tool. So yes, asking, what is this moment lacking? Just helping me appreciate what's going on in the present, and what, talking to myself, what do I need? And then who is listening to these thoughts? I think those are the big two, to kind of separate yourself as the observer, like the chaos in your head. That's what I would say. All right. And again, ooh, I like this one too. It says, what is the hardest thing that you've had to unlearn? The hardest thing I've had to unlearn: one, your value, your worth is not up for debate. And anybody who makes you feel differently is trying to get something out of you. Like, unquestionable, like the feeling that you got after your baptism, you're like, I'm clean. You can have that every day. So that would be a big one. And then the other thing is, if there's like a Mormon hate watching me right now and you want to clip this out and take this in the wrong way, be a douchebag. But if you're actually listening to what I'm saying, you'll see that this is probably something we can all benefit from. Whether Mormon or ex-Mormon or basically whoever you are, I have had to unlearn anything that has to do with a victim mindset. Nothing but validation in that sense. But I'm going to say for me, so for example, growing up Mormon, I was taught that enduring hardships or whatever came at me in life was all worth it if I was compliant, because that is the noble and the righteous thing to do. And so that that righteousness of like right and wrong is, again, that's its own deconstruction thing, but that's still well ingrained within all of us of wanting to be good and right and enduring something because you think it'll make you better. So it created this idea in my head that suffering was proof of my worthiness and that sacrificing myself for others was the ultimate sign of goodness. And as I say that out loud, I mean, like, so many different stories come to mind. So unlearning that mindset meant that I had to realize that my well-being mattered too. And that comes in the form of setting boundaries that aren't selfish, but actually make me healthy. Because if you're like, Carol, why'd you and Aaron get divorced? It's because I wasn't going to make him healthy. He wasn't going to make me healthy. And our sacrificing for each other in really unhelpful spiraling circles was never going to bring the best growth. So we had a really great moment last night. It was actually our 16th anniversary and on the 18th of December. And I noticed at like 10:30 at night, and I just was like, I've been fine. I haven't cried in months. It's been fine. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, one tear, then I got a whole bunch, to quote the Barbie movie. And it was just, it hit me in that moment and stuff. And so we've had some good talks because we've had so much space and so many boundaries over the last few months. And I cannot emphasize how much space we've had. Like, I'm actually mind-blowing how much space. And we've been completely out of each other's business. And he does him, I do me. And all of that space and stuff that just would not feel natural to us because of our nature as Mormons who wanted to get married and wanted to have the best marriage possible and be as meshed as possible, and thinking that that type of codependency and that type of journey that we take together is what is ultimately in the best interest of our religion and of our life and of our kids. Where now I would view us as if we were a rocket ship that took off together and everyone is a crowd that's watching. We're still a rocket ship going to like family awesome planet, but we're on different rocket ships now. We're just going to the same place. We get our own fuel. We know what time to show up. And when you're so meshed and into this idea of what goodness means, but it's not in actual alignment with what's healthiest for your journey or the other person's journey, you know you got to detach that Velcro. So unlearning that mindset to do things that were once seen as a sign of failure that are actually a sign of goodness, because it really depends on how you perceive things. Speaking of divorce, like, divorce only happens when it needs to happen. Like, people fall into marriages all the time. That, like, people get divorced on purpose. People get married on accident. So it's a surefire thing. It's something that absolutely is happening and should happen. So, like, when you could look out at the world and be like, all of these different things have let me down. I let myself down all the time. So the only thing I'm working on right now is like, Kara, make goals and gain confidence in yourself by being the person who shows up the way that you would want other people to show up if you expected them to. Like, wake up at the time that you said you were going to. Go to bed at the time that you said that you were going to, because the more that you keep promises to yourself, the more confidence you have that you can be trusted and your trust is not on somebody else and how they are keeping their promises or breaking them. So anything of that made sense, a lot of things that I've learned and rant. How did your nose get so crooked? So moving on to this subject, people are like, Kara, your nose is beautiful. Thank you so much. People ask me and I'm kind of talking about it. It's an interesting thing to me. So after I had my first baby in 2014, it's funny because my nose cartilage shifted. And then my sister took this picture, the one after my daughter was born, and I looked at it and it was the first time I ever noticed my nose was crooked. And I was like, my nose has never done that before. And now it's useful for Mormon men of the internet, as their favorite way to tell me through their insults that they suck. So it just cuts right through the garbage. And people ask me if I'm going to fix it. I'm looking at you dead on right now. Can't really be fixed. I asked a doctor and it's a cartilage problem that would just shift back after surgery. So I guess you could say I am in cartilage jail. Next, How do you move on from the trauma? I think I have addressed this pretty well. Reiterate the use of the phrase, given that, which shifts the focus from like the why me, how could this, but all valid, true. Given that, now what? For example, given that I was spiritually manipulated for decades, what's my next move? Any regrets on what you said or did from recovering from being Mormon? Again, it's like regrets, things that have happened and transpired, sure. But they've led me to where I am right now, and I'm really happy with where I am right now. So it's like time machine could have hurt that person less, could have shown up in this way, could have, you know, ducked instead of jumped, whatever. There's definitely regrets. But my main thing is shut up. Just shut up. Shutting up is usually the right answer. It's a big thing I learned the first day when I was at camp. When you have an option to do one thing or the other, just don't. Just don't. Shut up. Don't. Shut up some more. And if you're like, okay, don't, but then why are you doing? Have you thought about doing a grounding exercise yet? Didn't think so. Why are we not doing our grounding exercise? Why are we doing then? Don't tell me that I didn't don't you. And you just got to live with those consequences. And going back to the thing I've been talking about, like with radical honesty and doing things that, you know, are in your long-term well-being, radically honest about like, why are you going to do that? Let's be real. And then like, is this actually for your well-being, or is there some other sneaky reason you want to do this? Maybe there's something you should look into. You can spend a whole year gardening those questions and then just don't. So don'ting and shutting up, my favorite things. Now, with that being said, I cannot tell you how much, this is us talking like we're besties. Anyone else who's not, if you're not cool, get out of here. I have beaten myself up into trying to shame myself. And from that shame, trying to transform into something different or something that I'm not. That equation, it just, it's not going to work. But again, going back to like the sacrificing, like the more I shame myself, the better the results. No, that's a bad idea. That's in the past. We don't live like that anymore. So trying to transform out of that into somebody that I'm not or some ideal that I'm not, it's just that equation's not going to work. So I feel like I've beaten myself up for over a year for being so inclined to take risks. And that's kind of, I didn't realize until I was on a mushroom trip a couple weeks ago. I was living in an RV down by the Provo River. And I have not had a mushroom trip that actually gave me self-esteem and like said nice things to me in ever in my life. So this was a good nugget. But it was like, girlfriend, isn't that also like the best thing about you that you're inclined to take risks? And like, for better or for worse, like, that's just who you are. And you need to live in that reality, like be realistic that you're not just going to never take risks again. Just you need to do it in places that are more in alignment. And I'm like, oh my gosh, the mycelium network working for me again. So here's a story. So my parents told me that my favorite way to annoy them when I was a toddler would be climbing the monkey bars at the park and then go right to the middle and then stop and shout, help me, somebody, help me. And then they'd come and grab me and place me on the ground. And then I'd run to the ladder again and I'd go up to the middle of the monkey bars and I'd go, help me, somebody, help me. 3-year-old Kara, you crack me up. And if I was having a conversation with my 3-year-old self, she'd be like, we grew out of that, right? And I'd be like, no, actually, we still love putting ourselves in sticky situations for the bit because that's so us. And I have to say that most kids who grew up like me as the youngest of a large family and felt like abandoned at times didn't spell it out so clearly at such a young age. And I like to say that I was ahead of my time, dangling in danger all alone as a very physical manifestation for my inner emotional state during the only time that I had my parents' full attention. So for that, honestly, 3-year-old Kara, girl, slay. But still, I salivate at the opportunity to not know what's going to happen next. Yes, like it gets me hurt and it gets the people I love hurt sometimes. That is true, not to discount. But I do like, if we're talking like regrets in my post-Mormon journey, a lot of stories, a lot of stuff, a lot has transpired. But I am happy with my inclination to take risks. That is something that I've come to terms with. That is actually one of my favorite parts of myself. And it could just be, just needs to be bridled more and drink less. But, oh, another thing I want to say, that in uncovering so many of these things about Tim Ballard, my family is worried about my safety a lot. But great news for Justice and bad news for Tim is through speaking out about his crimes, even if it gets me killed, it's just what Cara Burrell does. So let me, example. So there was a time when I was backpacking when I was 18 through Glacier National Park. And my older sister and I were almost eaten by a grizzly bear. And it was a very transformative experience. And we stood on top of a boulder and this gigantic bear went through and like destroyed our campsite. Encircled us and we like wagged a stick on it while we had this mountain man next to us who was like also screaming and fearing for his life. And so my sister's crying and she's just hysterical. But I was really calm and I was just laughing and thought, this is so me. This is how I die. This is so main character of how I go out, you know? So whether it's bears or Tim or the Mormon Mafia, I just know that I'm going to do risky things. But if they make me smile and are in my best interest for my future self and also piss off the right animals like Tim Ballard, I'm on the right track of where I want to go. Next, what is your temple name? Ooh, Rachel. God gave me the prettiest character from Friends. And that to me meant that he loved me and that the church was true for way too long because I could have gotten a different name. I should have probably gotten Phoebe because that's who I have a long neck like her. But if you went through the temple on the 13th of a month, you probably have the name Rachel too. Rachel Gang. Next question. Are you non-dualistic in your spiritual journey? So if you can't tell already, let me break down further things. Non-dualism, which I can kind of explain if you don't know what I'm talking about in a second, it really helps with detaching from needing things to be a certain way. And again, releases this judgment that you want to place on things. So my spirituality feels most natural to me when I view the world as non-dualistic. The matter and the events and things that are going on are just basically expressions of energy, and my finite brain needs to shut the hell up that it can even pretend that it understands that like everything is fine. Everything has a balance and is essentially one, and that my job, how I show up, is to feel whatever is before me as the universe in that moment. If I'm like biting an apple or whatever, just resting in the truth that all of this is just how it should be, and that my perceptions of separateness or control do not really do any good if I'm on what my path is, which is hopefully to peace. So in practice, there's a saying that goes like, I have no friends or enemies. I have only teachers. And when you want to like gossip and bitch, it's not fun to talk like that. But that's 95% of my thoughts, my actions going towards that. Like when I was working at the camp, I went in saying, I will never say anything negative about somebody behind their back. And I had plenty of opportunities, of plenty of places to like bitch and moan and commiserate. And one, I trust no one. And two, I wanted my thoughts and my actions to be looking for the best in people and what they can contribute to like the whole of what we're trying to build here, which is like, you know, as much of a cohesive, happy summer for as many people as humanly possible. So seeing certain counselors where I really was like, I could bitch and moan about how I can't believe I have to manage this person all day long, knowing that they have something to contribute and investing my mind and my energy in uplifting them in that sphere and not the opposite, and not spending my time thinking about what they're not contributing and what they actually are contributing, mentally healthy for me and then better in how I show up and how I give, right? And so that's where like just the kind of boundaries and yes, like if all of these people are not friends or not enemies and just teachers, I could say that I've had teachers who have taught me one lesson and people who have taught me many. And sometimes the balance is just finding who to give, what teachers to give the keys to the campus to, who has access to your life and who doesn't, because that's just one lesson that they needed to be teaching you. And then you don't need any more, right? So dualism to me is, this is going to sound hippy-dippy, I don't care. It's kind of like if you're playing a video game, you're playing The Sims, and you're building a little sim house, and you're controlling everything from like what they wear and when they go to the bathroom and all that stuff. And you're feeling like you're the god of that game. But then if you can zoom out and realize that you're actually part of the game and that you're both, non-dualism would be saying that like there's no separation between me as the player and then my sim as the character, and that we're kind of all part of the same energy. We're all part of the same vibe, just experiencing life in different perspectives. So again, with the camp analogy, there's no like they are working against me when it can feel like that, because there's no me versus the world, because I am the world and it's all connected. And life isn't made up of like this or that, but you're the person holding the controller, and that everything is still all interconnected and that we're all part of the same big thing. I just have my vision over here. You have your vision over there. Next question, is soaking real? Some people perceive it to be. People ask me that a lot. I never heard of it until I got into the X-Armored space, probably. It's gotta be. I mean, I know the BYU students are doing the old poop hole loophole. That's, you know, Christian colleges, tales all this time. You know, content creator XMLX, I think she has said that she did do that while she was engaged when she was Mormon. So you'd have to talk to her about it. Maybe it's something she experienced. But is it actually real soaking? What's the definition of it? It's parking your car in the garage and just leaving it there. You're not going back out to get groceries or, you know, to the mailbox. You're just keeping it there. That's what soaking is. So never heard of it until I was on this side of stuff. But what do you guys think? Next question is, what do you believe about free will? Love this question. Will not expand upon it. I've done videos in the past. I've deleted them all because I used to not believe in free will. I was that kind of Sam Harris atheist. Now, for reasons I cannot expand upon, I do believe in free will. Next question. Have you had sex with a woman? I take that back. I don't believe in free will. Next question. What is your favorite piece of Mormon lore? Good one. My favorite, got three for you. And I cannot do any follow-up questions on the third one. One would be that Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery used to do washings and anointings in the temple in a big bath of cinnamon whiskey. Two is that the hot drinks part of the Word of Wisdom came from a belief that some quack doctors had, that hot soups and teas and et cetera literally made your body hot and made you sick. And the third one is that there is a gay member of the 70 who has had gay yearly retreats with his boyfriend for decades. All right, we've made it to the end. Last question I'm going to answer today is, has anyone ever told you that you are somebody's celebrity crush? Because you're definitely mine. Heart emoji, heart emoji, heart emoji. Thank you so much. We know that you have a lot of options when choosing celebrity crushes. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for choosing Nuanzo. But like a wise woman once said, a crush is just a lack of information. Well, that's all I have for you today. Thanks so much for joining me. And remember, don't let anyone else ruin your life. You ruin it for you. Love you so much.